Our next presenter is David Gall, and he's originally from Barbados, but he's currently teaching at University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He's an art educator. He's also a painter and sculptor, and one of the focus of his art of painting and sculpturing is Black male identity. He's also interested in multicultural, transnational, transracial representation of art, and he is teaching students about that. That's something that he wants his students to appreciate. As citizens of a global world, we can no longer stay separated. We are all part of a whole, yeah. You know, and we all have different parts there to play.
Okay.
Thanks. And the third part that he is doing is Reality on the Margins of Empire, Carl Brudhagen, an Artist Teacher Life.
Yeah. I'm going to be very different, of course, because I'm a visual artist. And my stuff is all visual. I did write I have a paper, but really and truly, when I heard it got 20 minutes, I said, you know what? I'm going to talk about my stuff and use my slides will be the quotations, quote, as it were.
I like it this way.
Yeah, so, first of all, let me tell you why. Well, Carl Brudhagen is a Barbadian. Well, see, there you go, creating problems. Originally born in Ghana, British Ghana, 1909, died in 2002, came to Barbados when he was like 15 years old with his mother. So he's a single mother and child, comes to Barbados, and he grows up in Barbados, effectively. But I would say that one of the things is his experience of Ghana, because of course he has a 15 years of living in Ghana, was very important to his life, because Ghana was much more diverse than Barbados is still, I would say. And at the time he came to Barbados, he told me, and you wouldn't hear me doing a lot of quotations. I've done a lot of interviews with Carl, so a lot of my stuff is like directly talking with him, as it were. When I was speaking to him once, he said, you know, when I first came to Barbados, the thing that struck me, because it was like black and white, right? Not East Indians or anything much were there, especially in 1924, right? So he said, like, it was so clearly different, you know? People's physiognomy was different, you know, because in Ghana you had all these mixtures, Amerindians and everything. It was really different. And that, I think, was something like a catalyst for some of the stuff that he did. To go quickly, though, he had to find work. I'm just going to give you a little background on his life so that you become familiar with who I'm talking to. So keep in mind that he's coming to Barbados in 1924. We are all still in the Caribbean, at least the English-speaking Caribbean, colonies of Britain. You have the French colonies, the Dutch, etc., but we are colonies of Britain and Ghana. And a lot of Barbadians actually had emigrated. We were the people, Barbados exported a lot of policemen and teachers, because we did have a lot of a good educational
nurses,
system.
Huh? Nurses that went to Canada,
He comes there, he's, of course, he basically has a middle school education, if you may call it that, and he has to find work, you know, he found some work on docks initially, but then his mother got him into trade, so he became a tailor. So the narrative I'm telling you really, and why I titled my thing on the margins of empire, and I explain these words because they have a lot to do with what I have to say in a way. On the margin of empire is because, in a sense, the Caribbean, by this time, is marginal to the empire. Okay? Eric Williams and a guy called Robin Blackburn, a recent guy who was actually, if you know Eric Williams' work, Capitalism and Slavery, one thing that Williams talks about in that text is that one of the things that happened to the British Empire is that it lost the US, when the U.S. Revolution, it lost the U.S. It had its eye on expanding, but the planters in the Caribbean were an obstacle. That, and Williams explains in a sense, that's part of the reason why abolition takes place. It was not all because they were nice. It was economically important for them to abolish slavery. And one of the other places that was important for them, of course, for them to do that, was India. India was looked at as this place, it was like the infinite continent for them. It had everything. It had every climate you could think of. So India was what they were looking towards, and the planters of the Caribbean. So there's this interesting global connection that I want you to keep in mind. But particularly what happens, of course, is that once sugar becomes less important, you know, industrialization takes off, you know, the Caribbean is not as important anymore. And so basically you're marginalized. And you don't get as much cultural development taking place in the Caribbean at that time. When Carl comes, he's saying, like, just to give you an idea of his experience, if you wanted to go into the library to get a book, somebody had to give you a reference, like a lawyer or something. This is just to get a book from the library, right? You had to get a reference, then you took it to the library, and you were allowed to borrow books. But at that time, you couldn't even go into the library. There was a counter, and you went to the person at the counter and told them the subject you were interested in, and they would go and look for the book. Now, I mentioned that because he became a tailor. Good. His mother got him into tailoring because she said, learn a trade, that's how you're going to make money. Good. But he became interested in art. This is over some years, right? He became interested in, he used to draw the people he's going to fit suits for. He becomes interested in art. But he's a guy with a middle school education, basically, right? So he's teaching, he has to go to the library to get books to teach himself art. There are few qualified artists around. There was like one in Barbados who had got a degree in art, a guy called Felix Haynes. But anyway, so not only are you on the margins of empire, but culturally, in a way, in terms of visual art, especially in the British Empire, literature is far more important than the visual art. So, I would say Spanish-speaking cultures have a lot richer visual tradition than the British conveyed to us. But anyhow, we compensate for that with our own stuff. So Carl teaches himself art, really. You know, he chooses one of the most difficult sculptures. He teaches them drawing, painting, and so on, but he takes up sculpture, which again, there was nobody around. There were a few people doing drawing and painting, but there's nobody around doing sculpture, really. So he's learning all this stuff from books. Good. And he's teaching himself. Actually, he does a great job, and he becomes one of the persons that you eventually go to if you want to cast things, etc. He becomes a really good sculptor. The other thing, well, it's in reality, of course, he's interested as a person that is, he doesn't know anything about abstract art, etc., etc. Because when you're sort of interested in art, you tend to think, I want to do something that looks like something else in visual art. So all of his stuff, I wish it was a little brighter, I put those up to show that the majority of his work is portraiture. The majority of his work is portraits. Painting and sculpture. And they're usually up here. Or sometimes a bust. But I want to go back a little bit. These are some, and you will see me using slides. I really wish, could you dim those lights a little bit, maybe? Because then you'll see why if it's possible. Okay, yeah, great. And it isn't as bright as I would like, but this is examples in a sense of European artwork. But they're not chosen accidentally. Of course, nobody does. Yourself. This is by, I'm not good at pronouncing French, so I think her name is Benoist. This is a female artist, European artist. And that's actually a man, Anne-Louis Giraudet. And the subject is Jean-Baptiste Bellet. He was a Haitian, actually born originally in Senegal. And he becomes a citizen, or on the French, after the French Revolution, he becomes one of these people who is like a councilman. Good. So you get this, I use these in a sense to signify, in a way, revolutionary France and revolutionary Haiti. Because our background, keep in mind, one of the things that we are concerned with really in the Caribbean is revolution, is resistance to colonialism. And nothing symbolizes that, I think, better than Haiti for me. It's the only slave colony that, or slave society, that actually threw the imperialists out by revolution. Good. And they didn't need Hegel to inform them of how to do that. These are people who understood how to overthrow an imperial establishment. But what I want you to look at is, Carl is also, I will refer to him as Carl because he's a friend of mine, old friend of mine. You know, Carl was interested in portraiture and in many cases women. But why I focus on especially Benoist's portrait of this woman, even though one of the things about European art and traditions is the sexualization of images of women. It's always, it's nudes, there is an objectification of the female that is consistent there. And this has been critiqued thoroughly in postmodern by feminists and so on. This has been totally thrashed to pieces with good reason, that woman becomes an object. And so that's one of the things I want us to keep in mind, that even though a tradition of doing things sort of like is hegemonic, it subtly indoctrinates you into doing something, into an identity that it might be against your own best interests. And that's probably what's happening with even Benoist. Even though she is unique in the way that she looks at this black woman really as an individual. She's not stereotyping this person. She really has looked at her as an individual human being. But the gender thing is there. The traditions, I think, are strong still. But what I want us to keep in mind, and this one nice thing that visuals can do that words can't quite do. This is the environment. This is the environment of race and race science, especially emerging in the 19th century. And you mentioned the abolition of slavery, first the slave trade in 1907, and then the Emancipation Act in 1833. Even after that, you still really, the British were extremely proud of this achievement, but they were still trading with Brazil and the United States, all of which had slave societies, And because they had achieved what they wanted, they could now trade, they could now deal with India and the East. And that's where they could build their empire. That's how they became a global empire. But these are some of the physical, the stereotypes. And when you see them visually there, this is projected as science. This is not art, in a sense. This was the science of race that you're seeing. Good? What I want to impress on you is that's the kind of, even though perhaps Bluthagen did not see these, I'm sure he probably did, these particular images, that whole ideology is all around you. Good? How, in a sense, you are denigrated physically. Good. And one of the reasons I think he takes up portraiture so much It's not only because of that initial shock that he experienced when it comes to Barbados, that people are so different. the mixtures are so different. But it's because of this thing. It clearly seems to me that Carl is convinced that Caribbean people are varied and beautiful. This was something that you would hear him on. He was fascinated with the way different people looked, and the mixtures that were there. That was fascinating for him. And so part of it was that he would actually go behind people. Or if he found a person looking interested, he would go and ask them to sit for him. This is what an artist has to do, of course. If you find something, especially because he's a figurative kind of person, he is going to look and try to get you to sit for him so that he... And the other thing is that, remember, he's coming up at a time when there is nothing there. It's difficult to get a model, even. Okay? This is truly a barren thing for visual arts. But, I put this up. This is Andromeda. In that 19th century, of course, slavery is abolished. There was a great, the first international industrial exhibition. I don't know if you know about it, called the Crystal Palace Exhibition. This was the first international exhibition on Earth. Okay? Industrial products, but also art. And you were talking about categories and stuff like that. That's one of the places where you see scientifically, because the very exhibition, especially British and the East and Indian exhibition, because British, one of the things that was happening in that exhibition that the East India Company wanted to showcase India and convince the rest of Britain that this project of dominating India is a good one. India has this stuff for us. Textiles, whatever you name it, can be done there. In that exhibition, and I've used these classical sculptures purposefully, one on the left is by an American sculptor called Hiram Powers. And you can see he's interested in the nude. Good. It's called the Greek Slave. Good. This is the kind of work that Rudy might have been looking at to teach himself how to sculpt. Good. So he could easily have been sort of like socialized into the same kind of gender sort of like attitudes, you can say. Good. Because the nude is like, yes, it's the thing to do for an artist. Good. On the right, another sculpture by a guy called, let's see his name, is John Bull. I forgot I put it there. Bell. And that's a sculpture of Andromeda. Anybody have any idea who Andromeda is or what she's about? I'm a teacher, so I ask these questions after. Andromeda is a heroine of a Greek myth. Okay? Perseus rescues Andromeda from the Kraken or whatever it is, right? But Andromeda is an Ethiopian princess. So, and this has been going on for centuries. I mentioned that because it almost becomes, you have the Greek Slave by Hiram Powers, and Powers was supposed to be sympathetic to abolitionist causes. But it's almost like he could not represent a black slave, woman, female. But he was also actually referring to, at that same time, there was a lot of the Greek wars, with the Turkish Greek wars were going on, and that's where Byron dies and stuff like that. And I think he was, in a sense, referring to that, the possibility that Greek women could be enslaved by Turks. So that was his preference, as it were, because it was probably not, he probably felt that a black female slave would not be as sublime to represent as I put this image here. I really wish it was brighter. Just to give you an idea of how pervasive this idea of representation is. This is a still from the movie Clash of the Titans. Anybody seen this thing? Y'all don't watch TV? Watch it. The Clash of the Titans is made in 2006 or something like that. Alexa Davalos is Andromeda. And it's like, will nothing change? This is the whole issue. If this is going on now, you can imagine what the environment was for Carl Brueghel, when there's nothing, and all he's seen in classical. I mean, we have post-colonial theory, etc. now to inform students about resistance and cultural resistance and stuff like that. She couldn't be Andromeda. Somehow they couldn't find her. This is Gina Torres. You see, I deal with physical things, right? So she acts in the TV series called Suits, something like that, with a lot of lawyers. She's this high-powered woman, who is like a CEO kind of thing, or one of the top board members, or whatever you might call it. And there she is, beautiful black woman, but they couldn't find somebody like that to do Andromeda. So, to give you an idea, Brueghel works in an even more colonized environment, I would say, a harsh environment of colonization, because he is a colonial subject. Yeah? This is a few scenes from Barbados. The amount of visual culture in Barbados was very limited, really. You had churches, Anglican churches, nothing much. Stained glass windows, maybe. few relief sculptures inside. And, of course, some monuments, Lord Nelson. This is a painting by Benjamin West, an American artist, of Christ in St. George Church. So you don't get a lot. You get some English representations of 18th century Barbadian life. This is Rachel Pringle, and it's by a guy called Thomas Rawlinson. And he's like a satirist, a British satirist, and he actually paints. This Rachel Pringle was a hotelier. So you want few representations of black women in the Caribbean in the 17th, 18th century. So you can see her. She's a hotelier. Hotelier in Bigginford. It was a brothel, really. So the men there, he's satirizing the fact that these white plantation owners, etc., are lecherously looking at that beautiful young woman in there, mixed and so on. So, but keep in mind one thing, that this is a colonial situation. Rachel Pringle is staring at us. This is an intelligent woman, powerful woman. Good. And somehow Rawlinson gets that, somehow. But the sexual part, you notice the sexualization of women, even though it's about sexual activity, again, that we are connecting women with here. There's a historian called Pedro Welch who has done a lot of good studies on Caribbean women in that period. And one of the things that he was talking about with freed women, especially like Rachel Pringle, was that they actually used their money to help purchase others from slavery, buy them out, as it were, or get them to a place where they could buy their freedom. So this is not just a sort of man. She was doing more than that. So you can have a bigger look at it. Good. So that's Rachel Pringle. But like I said, Brueghel was completely interested in people. So portraiture becomes the thing he does. And you might ask, well, so realism, that's part of the thing that he's interested in, not abstract art, as it were. Portraits and people. And what he chooses to do, he's always very conscious of he's growing up at the time when, there's a lot of struggle for you know, just the right to vote. You know, so he's involved in that kind of struggle at that time. But remember, he's a tailor. Up to this point, he is still a tailor. But he eventually becomes a teacher of art at the high school that I went to, a high school called Common Mayor. And that was because, and there's a literary connection here, he had obviously developed himself so well that he began to attract attention. And the high school, because remember, there was no University of the West Indies. If you wanted to study, you had to go outside. Britain, Canada, the US, wherever, France, nothing is there in the Caribbean College University yet. So the high school in question is Combermere, the Combermere School, named after Lord Combermere, son, Lord, of course. and an English headmaster, a guy called Major Newton, was very far-seeing. He decided that I want to have arts in my school, in this school. And Common Mayor note that the English have schools in a hierarchy. But you get the top schools, you know, and you come down. So top students went to the top school, middle, and so on. So the schools down at the end always had a lot of problems, right? Because the socioeconomic. A lot of socioeconomic issues are there, but at that time it didn't really matter because you had a small middle class anyhow. Good, and most of the populace was poor and black. Good, so if you got into that top school, you had to be bright. Good. The other problem at that time was that you had to pay. So if you didn't get a bursary or whatever, you didn't go. Good. So unless your parents had the money. So one of the things that Newt did was, and Frank Cullimore was the deputy head of that school. Frank Cullimore was very much one of those pioneers of arts in the Caribbean, really, in terms of writing and some literature. He, with George Lamin's help, gets Rudy to come and teach art at that school. So he's moved now from being a tailor to a teacher. Good. But he's making a little more money, a little more, not much. but he's to pursue this art profession with more vigor. Good. And this is the head of he always showed people that were doing something interesting. Good. John Beckles was a social activist kind of person. Looked after, like, he organized some of the earliest things for, like, daycare for women who had to go to work and didn't have a place for the so portrait of John Beckles. This is a portrait of Reverend Frank Lawrence. And there are a lot of different portraits. He's had a Richard B. Moore. I don't even know who Richard B. Moore is. Very important African-American. Well, he was from the Caribbean, but he did a lot of stuff in the U.S., Richard B. Moore, in New York and so on, with civil rights and stuff like that. But Lawrence was a Methodist minister, but also apparently very interested in the poor. So he did a lot of stuff. And Broody had nothing in his bones about race in that sense. But he knew, of course, the kind of thing, but he respected people who did things for others. And Lawrence was like that. He also still had to be interested in your portrait. There was something there that had to move him in a way. So, Reverend Lawrence. But a lot of his stuff was of women. And these are not necessarily women who did anything fantastic. Some of them were good. But he just was interested in their beauty, you would think, anyhow. And I don't use beauty in a typical sense. You had to have a presence. I can only use that term for him to be interested. You know, and he would pursue sometimes something about this person does something, and he would pursue. This is a woman called Miss Daniel Ben, and he loved the idea that all of the Caribbean had these different forms of costume, you know. Barbadians, he told, this is something I didn't know. He said Barbadians tended to dress in white and wear white turbans at that time. The other islanders were very colorful. So again, things that I didn't have a clue about, you know, because here I am growing up with him as a teacher. But he was very terribly observant. This, just to fit in again some of his background, this is a guy that was a scout, was a scout leader, he was a boxer, he did ballroom dancing. This is just an all-around, he taught women knitting, he taught the Women's League knitting, he had taught himself knitting. So this is a multi-talented person, believe it. Good. So I mentioned that to emphasize the fact of how the colonial sort of the empire stifles people like him, or stifles people like him. But he resisted, of course. This is his resistance. His art becomes his resistance, to this thing that would stifle creativity. And he's just doing it because he had this passion for human rights in a way too. I mentioned that because he would tell stories he went to another Barbadian artist asking for help. But this person did have some training in painting and drawing and stuff like that. And he was asking for help. And the person was going to charge him some money. He said, what the heck was he doing charging me money? I had no money. So he became determined, and this was part of his characteristic, he became determined to teach sometimes freely. This is the kind of person, so the more he became an expert at doing what he was doing, he actually went to the different islands and Ghana, back home for him, to his second home, first home in a way, to teach. He went to Trinidad a lot to teach sculpture and drawing. So he really did a lot of stuff. Anyway, this is, I wish it was brighter, but this is a person that was just, this is Ma Sammy. She lived in a place called Subtle Street, which he would pass on his way to work as a tailor. And struck by this woman, this was like, there's something about this. So one of the things I'm emphasizing is, in a way, how different is his approach to women. The gender thing, it's not that he's not interested in nudes, but the sexualization of women is not what you see going on with him. You don't see it at all. He has like two or three sculptures and a painting of a woman, of women maybe with nude up to that point. But they're just like studies, but generally, this is what he does. There's a young woman called Kathy. Again, it's for whatever reason, he chooses to portray individuals that have something, personality of some sort. Now, keep in mind, this is not, a lot of revolutionary things have happened outside, let's say in terms of visual art, cubism, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not how I think we should be judging people like Carl. But here is a person, when you think of that racial context, if you look back to those slides, which in a sense, the science, race science that was trying to tell you that you're inherently ugly in every way. he is resisting that completely in this very act of portraying women. He would say he would be in his studio, because he eventually was able to get a studio, and he said one day I was a woman passed, she had the most beautiful neck and he ran down and got her to come and pose for him. This is Bernardine. He has quite a few things of this young woman. This is Anne Marie Asing, Chinese Trinidadian. So tight, beautiful paintings. Oh, I wish this was brighter. This is actually Nina Lamming. This was George Lamming's first wife, I think. Broody met, because they were friends, you know, Lamming and remember, Lamming and Cullimore were responsible for getting him this job at the school. But Broody was also lucky to get us, again, through this principal, Major New, and this is colonialism. This is some of the contradictory stuff with colonialism, in a way. New was definitely of the empire. He was a Major New, after, you know, he's from the military too. But he was he's a person who had vision, you know. He got a scholarship for Bodega to spend 2 years at Goldsmiths College to do some art, to get some sort of qualification. And of course, what Broody did, and what they told him to do when he got there, he said, like, you can do certain things already. Go and visit France and get to the museums and see as much as you like, or you can, and learn as much as you can that way. But of course, this is a serious intellect that you're unleashing in these places. He once commented to me, you know, you could see how race operates and culture operates in a museum so clearly. He would say, like, you're going to the National Gallery, anyhow. And he said, like, all this, everything that was, you know, classical European was up and very nicely laid out. And when you went down the African section, not much. But it was there, but it wasn't as neatly, it wasn't as presented, you know, and that was clear to him, you know, this, that the colonial categories were institutionalized there visually for you. Okay, so this is Nina, but again, there are a lot of things I could tell you in terms of the subtlety in the way he paints. He's a bit influenced by this time. This after he comes back from Britain, and he has seen a lot of impressionist, post-impressionist work, and remember, already the Europe is being influenced by non-Western art. First of all, the Asian art, by Japan in particular, and then African art transforms the whole thing in a way. One of the things that becomes important for him, at least an important point in his development as an artist, is that during the 60s and 70s, when you had the big Afro Black Power stuff going on in the 60s and stuff like that, he becomes fascinated with Afros. And it's because it's like, it was one of the most visual statements you can make, you know, with your body. And he does four sculptures. One is Lost. He said, there was first one he did, he sent to Trinidad for an exhibition, it never came back. Okay, so we don't know where that one is. And he did, this is a second one that he did, and he did one that became a gift to Chinese government, so it's in China somewhere. And all right, so this first one, but what is significant about these works is that they're not done from observation. This is the one time that he decides, I'm not going to be looking at anybody, I'm portraying any actual person. This is now, in a sense, conceptual. Good, to use an interesting term. It's out of his imagination, out of his experience of Black women in particular in this case. And it's a really important part of his oeuvre, I would say. This one called Serenity, it's in the Barbados government owns it. It used to be in the Hilton Hotel for a time, when we had a Hilton Hotel. It's now like demolished and replaced. But it's owned by the Barbados government. Ebony is a very hard wood. It's extremely hard. So to carve it is something itself. But so This is one of them. This, the other one, Benin Head. And this is really the climax of the month, I would say. The other one that went to China, you don't have a slide of, was also Afro, and with earrings. He'd actually made brass earrings and put them on, so it was a little bit of an unusual thing. But all of these portraits are very intense. Somehow, one of the things that for me characterizes them, you know, because Brudi was always, he would say things like, I'm not interested in people smiling. Smiles are superficial. You know, and, you know, it's like, you know, sadness, smiling, that's not people. You know, that's superficial stuff. What they are, you know, and he was very expressive. Like, I'm sure you know, you know, what they are can't be shown in that. So that's why you see all of his faces, all his portraits, everybody's serious, as it were, absorbed in themselves, in their own sort of like being. One of the things I think is important with Brudi really is this peculiar, I would call it intuition for now, about the beingness of people. This is what, to me, is what he's getting at. It's something that you see in the best of any artwork, but you see a lot of it in certain forms of African art, believe it. And it comes from an aesthetic that is similar, I would say. When you look at some, when you listen to some of the African, well, those who research and found out what they think is great about their work, not just what a European critic is saying, but you've had people who have like gone and spoken with traditional African artists. This is why the work is good, right? And all of them come up with this interesting thing, like it's like, you know, it has this presence. Again, to the work is not smiling. It's never like that, but it has this thing that's there. They also talk about it in terms of dance, that when you're dancing, it's not like this certain sense of absorption in self tends to come out as something much more profound than anything else. And Brudi seemed to have got to that very place. The moment he sort of steps out from realism, as it were, I think this is still a realism, but it's like super real, maybe, you know, in the sense that it's about the essence of something. But, that's one of the things I think he achieves with these works. He doesn't do a lot of them. This brings me back to the whole colonial situation. He cannot do a lot of work. He cannot produce a lot of work. Even though he has a good job, you know, he's earning more now. Remember, he still has like his degree, if you may call it like that, was still like 2 years study. You know, it's not a full degree of any sort. So he's had three children, you know, to support, and a wife. And, you know, they did well, but the thing is, when they're growing up, he's the breadwinner. But so you don't have time. He didn't have time. This is part of the colonial condition, to really, in a sense, do a lot of stuff, to do as much as he would be probably, under different circumstances, would have been able to do. I don't know how I'm doing for time, but I thought I had 20 minutes. I'm almost sure I'm there. Actually 34, so I'm almost done. I wish you could read that. If you can, I'll read it for you though. There is a, I chose this quote from, it's from an Indian sage, modern sage, Aurobindo Ghosh. I don't know if anybody heard of Aurobindo. He's called Rishi Aurobindo. Rishi means like the great sage. And Aurobindo, just to give you a little history of Aurobindo comes around, he spans the period of independence, and he was, for great yogi, he became a great yogi, yeah. But he was, unlike Gandhi, Aurobindo felt you should throw the British out by the gun. He said they have to go by whatever means, violent or not, they have to go. but he left the freedom struggle and became a great yogi because he was practicing. And he really became a great sage and a great philosopher and writer. And one of the things he says about being, for me, that is, to me, connects with the way Buddha perceives in those works, and even in some of the in the portraits of women and so on that he's done, is this idea of a self that is not just physical. But it is in the physical, but it's more than that. Alright? So he said the secret self within us is an intuitive self, and this intuitive self is seated in every center of our being. The physical, the nervous, the emotional, the volitional, the conceptual or cognitive, and in the higher, more directly spiritual centers. And why I put that there in a way, for me, I currently am reading a lot of, by a guy called Roy Bhaskar. I don't know if you've ever heard of Roy Bhaskar. I will recommend Roy Bhaskar. Even better than Horny Baba, but yeah. No, Bhaskar to me is one of the solidest critics of post-colonial thought. Anything really. He's a sociologist, but I think he's got a great handle on it. He is actually his father was Sikh, and his mother was British, so he's a hybrid too. But Bhaskar has come up with an idea of stratified identity that isn't dualistic. He really sort of like has come up with explanations of social processes which are not dualistic and binary, but sort of afflicted by binarisms. Done a really great critique to me of Western philosophy and disentangle some of its problems. But I say that to say this, you know, I think a lot of what we talk about right now, in especially a lot of post-colonial, which post-colonial theory and stuff is great, but I think the East has already said certain things and done certain things philosophically that we have now arrived at. That's why I like this guy very much as well. He comes up with some interesting. Aurobindo is a really profound sage. But the other things are there that, to me, give you a different perspective on identity that can provide you with useful ways of looking at both society and individual agency, as it were. So I will just, the last two things to mention, I didn't mention this. That's his. You have a very few sculptures about for emancipation around. In Guyana, there's one by Philip Moore. Yeah, I didn't have a copy. I didn't have a thing of his. But this one is Jamaica. That one is somewhere in the United States, in Boston. And you can see how differently the free person conceives of emancipation. The one with Lincoln up there, you know, the slave is represented as so grateful for you to have freed me kind of thing, you know. But that's not what Buddha does. The slave has broken his chains. The Jamaican one is different. That's the Cuban one over there. I just wanted you to see like how he thought about emancipation. And this was a sculpture that he did. It's now a prominent sculpture in Margaret's. They made it a monument. Looking at a particular party, I don't know what it's called now. Can't remember the name of this, but it's a crossroads too. Good. That's always significant for us. And every Emancipation Day, there's a festival, sort of like one of the most serious sort of celebrations take place at that statue. It's called Bassa, because he was like one of our revolutionaries, sort of like slave rebels, as it were. But that elicited some very interesting responses from the public, which I will just mention a little bit. people thought it was ugly. It's like, so interested to listen to some of these comments, you know. And one of the things that Buddy told me is when he was, because I saw the little market, because this is before, he had done it just for himself, you know. And he said, but slavery doesn't make you refine, you know. It's like slavery crucifies people, you know. So it wasn't like, but he said, but this person resisted. This is nothing to do with ugliness. This is what, you can't just think that because a person looks a certain way that they're supposed to be trapped in anything. This person resists that. That was his idea, you know, that, you know. But of course, you will get, I've never forgotten one of the, I can't quote it totally, but a guy wrote, when it was first put up, he said, oh, he would have preferred a statue that was, you know, of a man with a chain dragging behind and looking towards the east and all this wonderful sort of like stuff, you know. But that's not what Rudy thought of. But he thought of the more sort of like thing of breaking, you know, and also the exhilaration of freeing yourself. Not somebody freeing you, but freeing yourself. But, okay, so I think that's where I end. That's the people doing that festival. It becomes very beautiful because the flowers are sort of like just deposited around the base. So when you see it at the end, it's like just this riot of color. Anyhow, so thank you. That is my idea. Done. I hope you enjoy. And I'm not a literary person, of course. I'm a visual person. Thanks very much.
This is the view, you know, for me.